Hello, fellow Americans. I'm Jeff Horwich, and this is The Week from In the Loop. Well, I guess this means now I actually have to go back and finish Barack Obama's book. I had skimmed my way to about two-thirds into Audacity of Hope. Then I realized I might be wasting my time if he didn't actually win the thing. But I'll get back to it now. It's interesting to read what he had to say before he was running for president. A lot of the stuff is similar. His healthcare plan in there, for example, was pretty well fleshed out in the book. But there's a lot of stuff in the book that did not make it through the filter of a campaign. Especially, I noticed some real tough talk about unions and the realities of global trade. The book, I should say, is way, way easier to follow than a typical Obama debate answer. We'll have to see if the Barack Obama of the book has been wiped out by our national political process, or whether it comes back now that the pressure of winning is gone. It seems like now would be the time, while the president-elect still has this whole golden boy thing going for him. That's the same effect, of course, that makes it so tough to poke fun at the guy. Without Sarah Palin, Lord knows what they're left with at Saturday Night Live. Lots of people, myself included, are contemplating satire and political humor in the age of Obama, which is why I called up Nick Anderson for a chat. Nick is the editorial cartoonist at the Houston Chronicle, here to talk with us about how his world is changing. Nick, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here, Jeff.
So, first question, of course, what are you going to do without President Bush to kick around anymore?
Well, he has been very good to me. I do think he just sort of had a funny look about him, and his demeanor and his posture was easy to have a lot of fun with. But at pretty much at the end of every administration, people have said to me, what are you going to do now? You had such good fodder with the last guy. But it's never been a problem so far. Everybody has been very good to me. Obama, it's probably a little bit less obvious how Obama will provide fodder to cartoonists, but I'm sure he won't disappoint. And if he does, then there are so many other people in Washington who will rise to the occasion, I'm sure.
Well, I saw your first big post-election Obama cartoon was of the, and maybe there is a word for this in the business, but I'd say it was of the non-funny variety.
Exactly, yeah. It was the one with Obama standing tall in America and labeled on America, it says Land of Opportunity, and Uncle Sam is saying to the rest of the world, see? Yeah, it's a non-funny cartoon. It's trying to just convey a message. And in that context, I didn't want to go with the funny approach. I wanted to try to say something a little bit more profound.
But you have to be funny eventually, don't you? And how are you going to do that with Obama specifically? Is he difficult for you to sort of take that cynical stance that you do need to take?
To the extent that I like him and have been more supportive of him than others, then that is the case. And I think, you know, I think from time to time I do owe him a few zingers just to kind of keep things even. But I don't think I necessarily need to be perfectly even-handed because it's I'm like a columnist. I have an editorial point of view, and it's perfectly legitimate to support somebody or be less hard on one guy over another or woman because we have, you know, our set of opinions. I think as we get into the substance of the administration and things become controversial, people are going to revert to form and people are going to do what they've always done, which is to give the president a hard time.
You've got a theory that political humor might actually get smarter under Obama. Tell me how that would work.
That's a good way of putting it. Yeah, because there's a couple of different approaches to this. One is the more character-driven satire where you're just ridiculing how ridiculous somebody's behaving. Clinton was all the sexual peccadilloes. And, you know, that stuff was funny for a while, but it got pretty old. And I was happy when his administration ended. I wanted to take a long shower. With Obama, it might turn us more toward the other kind of satire, which is more deconstructing issues and getting into the substance of issues, which is heavier lifting and a little harder to do, but it maybe serves the public a little better. And it's also harder to be funny about that kind of stuff. Like I might get, like, universal health care. Rather than focus on the personalities in it, like if Obama's pushing it and I tend to think we need that, then I will get into the substance of the issue and ridicule the mindset, like, say, they say that we have a free market system and universal health care, and I actually think that our current healthcare system undermines the free market, and that people make decisions to stay in a job they don't want, and they might not start a new business because they'd have to give up their health insurance.
And let me just say, that sounds hilarious.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's not funny, and I'm sorry I'm not giving you a funny interview, but
that's
the thing
right.
is, what I'll do is, I don't set out to be funny, but a lot of times it happens in the course of things.
And I should say, for the benefit of listeners who haven't seen your work is very funny. It does come from somewhere. It's just not the process you might expect.
Exactly. I'll start out with a real serious approach like that. The next day, everyone will say, oh, that's a hilarious cartoon. And when I do set out to be funny, it always seems to kind of fall flat.
Well, Nick, this has actually been a lot of fun. Thanks a lot.
Well, great. Thanks, Jeff. Appreciate it.
Nick Anderson is the editorial cartoonist for the Houston Chronicle. You can check out his blog, sketchbook, and animated cartoons at cron.com, or we'll link you straight there from our website, minnesotapublicradio.org/theweek. Now, everybody, I'm going to ask you to pay attention closely, because we're going to try something here that I don't think has ever been attempted before on the radio, inspired by watching CNN the other night on election night. Our producer, Sandon Totten, is going to join me now as a 3D hologram from his desk. Somebody's flipped the switch, so I should be...
Jeff, can you see me?
Yes. Just sitting next to me, just real as life.
This is cool. This is
amazing.
Really cool.
Amazing. How are we doing this?
Well, okay, so right now I'm at my desk, and they've got 35 different cameras. They're circling me. They're surveying every nook and cranny of my body to bring you the full Sandon Totten experience in 3D, as if I was just sitting right next to you.
The money that it must take to do this is just hard to imagine, but the effect really is spectacular. But of course, you're not here to talk about the hologram.
Right.
You're here to talk about a study you ran across this week, just in time for the election, showing us which political party has a better sense of humor.
Right. This was a study by Psychology Today. They went out and surveyed a bunch of people, some liberal, some conservative, and they asked them to rank a series of jokes from 1 to 9 on how funny they were.
Some examples.
Here's a joke. Okay. Husband says to his wife, "When I get mad at you, honey, you never fight back. How do you control your anger?" The wife says, "I clean the toilet bowl." The husband goes, "How does that help?" She says, "I use your toothbrush."
So does anybody think that's funny is one question. But all right, what's another example?
Well, they also used some more bizarre jokes, like this one from the Saturday Night Live standard Jack Handy's Deep Thoughts.
"It takes a big man to cry, but it takes a bigger man to laugh at that man."
And what do they find? Who's got the better sense of humor?
Well, the Democrats may have swept the elections on Tuesday, but it looks like Republicans have the last laugh, because overwhelmingly conservatives found the jokes funnier, which is funny because liberals said they thought they were funnier, but they didn't laugh as much.
So what are the theories about why Republicans, conservatives would have a better sense of humor?
Well, the New York Times quoted a psychologist who basically said conservatives tend to be happier than liberals in general. Conservative outlook rationalizes social inequality, kind of accepts the world as it is, whereas the liberal outlook leads to dissatisfaction and a sense that things need to change before one can really be happy and enjoy a good joke.
Well, so says the New York Times anyway. Everybody can have their own theories. Sandon, thanks for dropping by. By hologram, we're going to have to flip the switch and send you back now.
Okay. I'm ready for it.
See you later. Wow. Well, if you have no idea about the hologram thing we were just making fun of, if you didn't watch CNN on election night, we'll put a little video up for you to look at our loophole weblog at minnesotapublicradio.org. You know, 2012 seems like a long ways off, and it's kind of painful to imagine another election after just going through this big grueling one we had. But maybe with this election fresh in our minds, it's the best time to think about what we could change for next time around. Richard Hassan is a law professor at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles, and he writes the Election Law blog, where he's been contemplating some of the election system changes that might be in store for election 2012. Richard, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
First of all, you think the caucus system is due for an overhaul, and that seems like such distant history now. But remind us, what went wrong with the caucuses this time?
Well, if you remember the race between Senator Obama and Senator Clinton, there was a lot of dispute over what the rules were for casting ballots and counting ballots. In some places, such as Texas, the caucus system was simply overrun. They usually had around 100,000 people, and this time they had over 1 million people. In Iowa, which has had a long tradition of caucuses, there were complaints about the lack of a secret ballot in that process, and just generally disorganization, because these are often run by the parties and not by the state. A lot of complaints about the caucus system. And so I think we might be seeing more states move towards the use of a direct primary rather than a caucus in the next presidential election season.
Along with the caucuses, your second item you've been writing about, in 2012, you say, expect the law to open up and allow tons of outside money to be spent on the races. And I gather you're talking about outside groups, right? Like PACs and 527 organizations. Why is that going
to
happen?
Well, first of all, there's going to be a desire on the Republican side to raise as much money as possible. You know, we saw in this election, outside groups did not play too much of a role. I think there's a fairly good chance that within the next few years, the Supreme Court's going to consider some lawsuits challenging some of the rules related to PACs and other organizations, and perhaps open up the floodgates so that people could give unlimited sums to political action committees and other groups that want to influence the election.
And we've seen some evidence from some decisions already by this particular court that they're inclined in that direction.
The Roberts Court has considered three campaign finance lawsuits so far. In all three cases, it's either struck down the law or refined the law in such a way to allow for more money and more speech rather than allowing for Congress or the states to have reasonable regulation of campaign finances. If that trend continues and we see more of a loosening up of the process, we could see a lot more money flowing not just to the parties but to outside groups. And when outside groups participate, the quality of the campaign is somewhat different. We know that outside groups tend to be more negative. The more extreme ads against both Obama and McCain were coming from the third-party groups.
Maybe because the election result was so far beyond dispute, we haven't heard a whole lot, certainly not compared with 4 years ago, about voting problems. But were there big problems with voting this time around that you think might be addressed before the next election?
There were plenty of problems that occurred before Election Day. And believe me, if the election came down to Missouri, where they're still counting the votes and it's very close, then you'd be hearing a lot more about it and you'd be hearing how the system failed. There are all of these allegations this time about voter fraud and voter suppression, and that can undermine public confidence in the election process. The election was a blowout, and so people stopped paying attention to the problems we had with the system.
Well, the Democrats may have a certain incentive to look into the problems and make some changes by 2012. On the other hand, they won, and they won pretty big, and they're more or less in charge now. The current election system seemed to work pretty darn well for them. Is there really that much incentive to take a hard look at our election system before 2012 rolls around?
Senator Obama actually, when he was an adjunct professor at the University of Chicago Law School, taught a course in election law, and he's had an interest in election reform. In fact, a few years ago, a bunch of us were talking to him about various proposals he's had for fixing the election system. So I actually think this is a personal interest of his, and I would not be surprised if the White House has a proposal to try and fix some of these problems.
Oh, thanks for reminding us of that. That's actually an interesting sort of personal insight from his background that might make some of this more likely in the next 4 years. Rick, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Rick Hassan with us from Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. He writes regularly for Slate and pretty much every day at electionlawblog.org. Now, we're going to take this show far, far from the election in just a minute or two. But first, just some voices that we wanted to share with you. The stats tell us this presidential election result meant a lot to people across the economic and demographic spectrum. For many African Americans, of course, it's an especially potent moment. But the discussion is just beginning about what exactly Barack Obama's election does mean. Gail Turner is 52. She lives in Barber County, Alabama. That's a part of the country where voting itself was all but impossible for her family 40 years ago. We called her up earlier today.
Oh, my Lord. There are not words that I can say that could explain how I really feel on the inside. And I thank God that I was able to live to see the day that there was a change. On Tuesday, I sat up and I listened to his speech. He didn't make excuses for black failures. He didn't blame. But what he did was speak about a unified body of people.
That's Gail Turner from Alabama. Other people are celebrating, of course, but wondering out loud whether Barack Obama's election might actually create new challenges. This is Andre Cohen. He's 38 years old, and he lives here in the Twin Cities.
I had always thought about a day when there would be an African-American president, but I never knew what that day would look like. And this is that day. At the same time, one of my greatest fears is that as we accept this presidency, people will now say, because we have a black president, racism doesn't exist any longer. So there's no need for affirmative action. There's no need for protecting people who have not been a part of the mainstream part of society. Barack's victory does not necessarily translate into America being fully the best that she can be.
That's Andre Cohen from Anoka, Minnesota. Some African-American commentators are putting an even finer point on it. Here's something from a column our editor ran across on the website, The Daily Beast. Obama's victory creates an identity crisis for black men. Whom do we rail against if the guy in the Oval Office is one of us? Obama's election necessitates a rethinking of what it means to be a black man. Well, I'm hardly one to weigh in on this particular question, just to observe that the conversation's getting very complex and very deep very quickly. And conversation is rarely a bad thing. You are listening to The Week from In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich. We are online at minnesotapublicradio.org. Got a blog, podcast, the show, we're Twittering, all kinds of fun stuff all the time. The news this week, of course, was all about the election, but I'm sure you noticed the economic headlines there alongside to kind of rein in the excitement, perhaps. Job losses soared. U.S. auto companies are running on empty. Huge losses again in the stock market this week. Wouldn't it be nice to just leave this disaster of a global economy behind? Which is why we put in a call to the tiny Pacific island nation of Vanuatu. 200,000 people. It's 1,000 miles from anywhere, off the coast of Australia, I guess. Vanuatu is in the middle of a two-year push to stave off the cash and other temptations of the world economy and promote the traditional ways of living and doing business on the islands. Ralph Regan Vanu is maybe the biggest proponent of this idea. He's the director of the National Cultural Council, and he's a member of parliament on Vanuatu. Ralph, can you hear me there on the other side of the world?
Yes, loud and clear. Thanks.
Thanks for joining us. What are the key aspects of how the traditional economy, if we'll call it that, works on Vanuatu?
Our traditional economy is basically what the First Nations people of the United States had prior to colonization. In Vanuatu, we're very lucky that a large portion of that traditional economy is still around. Like 80% of people still basically satisfy almost all of their food needs from their own food gardens. Cash plays a very, very small role in most people's lives.
So how does something like private property, I suppose, which is a staple of the modern economy as we know it here in the U.S., how does that function on Vanuatu in the traditional economy?
Well, we don't have private property. That's a very key aspect of the traditional economy. There is no private property. All land is held by clans or extended family groups. It's only possible for a clan group to lease land to investors, for example, but there's no way a non-citizen can buy land outright.
It sounds from what you're saying like the traditional economy is still pretty strong. Why did it need protecting?
Well, simply because the people who are in our government are very much into developing Vanuatu along the lines that has happened in almost all other countries of the world, where the idea is grow our gross domestic product. We need to engage in economic growth. We saw that this emphasis on growing the cash economy led to people being encouraged to lease off the land and build oil palm plantations or to cut down their forests to sell for wood. The cash economy was actually reducing our food security, reducing our social security. So we were saying, look, if you want to grow the cash economy, don't do it by degrading the traditional economy, because it's the only proven system we have. The cash economy is not a proven system. And as this financial crisis has just shown, we better not put our eggs in that basket.
With the emphasis on the traditional economy, do you feel as if Vanuatu has been well insulated from the financial crisis that's tearing around the rest of the globe right now?
Oh, absolutely. We are very lucky here because in many ways we're one step ahead of many countries which are so entwined in the cash economy because we never got so far into it.
Now, you've said there's not much use for cash in the traditional economy there. But sometimes payments have to be made on the islands. I've read about people making payments in boar tusks, among other things.
Perhaps the most important one are live boars. They cultivate their tusks so that they grow out. The boars with the longer tusks have a greater value. You also have shells which are ground into discs and strung on twine, and the length determines the value. Also, a particular kind of yam we have here that grows very long is a wealth item in its own right. And so these items are used in ceremonial exchanges and life cycle ceremonies like births, deaths, marriage, and those kind of things.
Well, over here in the U.S., we are so far gone by comparison. It just head over heels wrapped up in this modern economic system. It's hard for us to imagine anything else. What do you think we can learn from you?
I just came back from a conference in Italy of what is called the slow food movement. It's a movement to come back to growing your own food and so on. Mm-hmm. And there were 153 countries there, and the biggest delegation there was from the United States. In the U.S., there's a lot of stuff happening like that, and it's all about emphasizing local economies. I know, for example, there's a movement in, I forget the name of the state. It's one of your northern states. Mm-hmm. Vermont, I think it is.
Sounds like it might be right.
Yeah, there's a movement to say, let's only buy products from within a 100-kilometer radius of where you live.
Not long ago, Vanuatu got named the happiest place on earth by a group called the New Economics Foundation. Is the traditional economy, you think, what makes you all so happy there?
Yeah, most definitely. The most significant factor that gave us that rating was the state of our natural environment. The way in which our environment has been managed over thousands of years is reflective of the way the traditional economy works.
It's kind of hard to tell over the phone. Are you a really happy person? Or are you just too worried about all this to really take part in the happiness of Vanuatu?
Some of us are quite skeptical about that rating by the New Economics Foundation because, you know, happiness is all subjective.
Well, Ralph, thanks for your patience with me. Of course, some of this is hard for your typical American to wrap his head around.
Yes.
Here's hoping the global financial crisis does largely pass you by in the end. Thanks very much for talking with me.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Ralph Reginvanu, cultural anthropologist and parliament member on the little island nation of Vanuatu, where today, well, we got our first snow. It was partly cloudy and 81 degrees. And that's why they're so happy. This is The Week. I'm Jeff Horwich. And before we go, a little tune, if you will, for the president-elect Barack Obama. One can only imagine what it is like to take office at a time like this. I just hope I can offer some small degree of encouragement. You know, campaigning is such a long and brutal process. But you finally got the prize right in your hands. All our hopes and fears are resting on your outstretched ears. So here's a little wish to help you through the coming years. Good luck, you're gonna need it. Something tells me it's all downhill from here. When you wake up Monday morning, I'm just giving you fair warning. You're gonna wonder why the heck you're in it now, up to your neck. Good luck, you're gonna need it. I'm sure you dreamed that this would be more fun. Oh, those many months ago, when you launched your campaign in the snow, you must admit you never thought you'd win the country we've now got. When it's 3 a.m. and you just can't get to sleep, try counting budget numbers or Afghanis herding sheep. Hey, didn't John McCain seem awfully gracious in defeat? Perhaps he finally realized this job is just for crazy guys. Good luck, you're gonna need it. Right now's about as good as it will get. I know you're floating on a cloud, made so many folks so very proud. But once you get in office, it's amazing how soon they forget. Good luck, you're gonna need it. You thought that you could do this, but nobody guaranteed it. The economy's gone south, just in time for you to lead it. Fresh Oval Office carpet, but your new puppy's gone and peed it. Oh, good luck, we're glad that we're not you, Barack. Good luck, you're gonna need it. The Week is produced by Sandon Totten and me. We are edited by Kate Smith, with special help this week from Anna Wagle in Public Insight Journalism. Find us online at minnesotapublicradio.org. I'm Jeff Horwich, and, gosh, next week we actually have a week without an election. Don't know what we're going to do with ourselves. Stay tuned.